Today on The Grave Talks, the Queen Mary. The Queen Mary is one of the last remaining ocean liners of a time gone by. The Queen Mary still holds the grandeur of a bygone era, as well as some of the passengers of that time. Many stories have been told over the last 40 years of the haunted Queen Mary and its storied past. What do these souls seek from the living? It's a question we try to answer on today's episode of The Grave Talks as we talk with Commodore Everett Horde of the Queen Mary. With a ship so old, it's easy to understand how rumors can easily become legends over time. However, one cannot deny the paranormal activity and hard evidence that's been collected on board the Queen Mary over the years. Sounds of men screaming in pain, faint noises of grand parties in an empty ballroom, children splashing and playing in a pool had been emptied of water long, long ago. What's the source of such paranormal activity? Sometimes it's easy to feel that we need to help a ghost cross over. However, what if that spirit's already crossed over to a place they want to be? What if that place is on board a ship that they loved in life? What if they're already at home and we're the ones invading their space? We may call it the haunted Queen Mary. They may simply call it their eternal home. Countless investigations have been conducted on board the historic ship, many producing compelling evidence for life beyond the grave. Lives that continue to be lived on board one of the most treasured ocean liners of all time. Today on The Grave Talks, an interview and a discussion that I have wanted to have for many years, as we discuss the haunted Queen Mary.
Well, Tony, the Queen Mary was conceived all the way back in the late 1920s, 1926 to be exact. Between 1926 and 1930, the designs were drafted and refined, and the keel was laid in 1930. A ship would have been completed in 1934 had the Great Depression not interrupted the construction, but because of a two-year delay, the maiden voyage was not until 1936. But when you look at the Queen Mary, you're really only seeing half the idea. The original idea that Cunard had in mind was that there would be two of the great ships of equal size and speed capability so that a weekly service could be run across the North Atlantic using just the two ships. They would be the largest and fastest ships on the planet, but they were the smallest and slowest ships that could do the job, and that is maintain a weekly service. And the reason for that statement is, in those days, it took a vessel of 1,000 feet in length to house enough machinery to cause the nearly 30-knot speed capabilities that would be needed to maintain that schedule for a five-day crossing year in and year out. And so the Queen Mary, as I said, the keel was laid to the Queen Mary on 1st of December, 1930. On the 10th of December, 1931, work was suspended. Most thought the ship would be scrapped before it ever saw the water. It didn't even have a name. It was only known as Job Number 534. And so over the next 2 years, the unfinished skeleton of the ship not only shouted failure to Cunard, to John Brown's ship company in Scotland where it was being built, but to the world. Because in those days, before the advent of jet travel, the countries having these capital ships to cross the Atlantic and were symbols of not only maritime power, but of overall power, a symbol of power. And so work had to be restarted on the 534, which the Queen Mary was called. And that would come at a cost. The British government was approached for grants or loans. White Star Line at the same time over in Belfast had a ship on the ways that would have been called Oceanic, also over 1,000 feet. Rather than have the government assist one company and not the other, the British government required that Cunard and White Star merge, form one solid, stable company, not dissecting the North Atlantic trade, and with that, they made loans to the new company, Cunard White Star, to finish the 534. The ship in Ireland, which would have been called Oceanic, was scrapped. So that took place in April of 1934. Work was restarted. By the late summer of 1934, the hull was nearly ready to launch into the River Clyde in Scotland, and still there was no name. There was a lot of betting going on around the country. Bookmakers were holding in first place the name Queen Victoria. And, of course, that name would have significance because in those days they considered Queen Victoria to be England's greatest queen. And also, she was the king's grandmother. And that would require royal permission. So overtures were sent out, and eventually one of the directors were invited to shoot grouse with the king. And while the two gentlemen are out shooting birds, the king makes a nice shot and lays his shotgun down and said to the director, "Well, Royden, how's that ship of yours coming along?" He said, "Oh, yes, sir, it's coming along quite nicely. And we'd like to name it after England's greatest queen." And with that, the king said, "Oh, that's the finest compliment anyone has ever paid my wife and I. I'll ask her permission as soon as I get home." So we have the Queen Mary and not the Queen Victoria. But so, as it turned out, one of the most successful things about the Queen Mary and her sister, which would be built 4 years later, the Queen Elizabeth, was the success in the naming. Because being named after two living queen consorts, it guaranteed the two vessels an instant popularity on the North Atlantic.
When she finally hit the water and was out on the open sea, what was life like on board the Queen Mary?
With the main voyage starting in 1936, the Queen Mary would instantly become the glamour girl of the North Atlantic. She was slightly smaller than the French Normandy, but had all the mystique of any ship that you might imagine after being named after a member of the royal family. John F. Kennedy would travel in the Queen Mary in the 1930s, Fred Astaire, Marlene Dietrich, Clark Gable. She would become the fastest ship in the North Atlantic. On the first occasion in 1936 in August, she would wrest the blue ribbon from the Normandy, and then again the Normandy would take it back, but in 1938 in August, the Queen Mary crossed the Atlantic in just 3 days, 20 hours and 42 minutes, with a record-breaking speed of 31.69 knots. And, of course, that record would stand all the way until 1952. And then, of course, with all of the glamour and the halcyon days of the 1930s coming to a close, war clouds were brewing in Europe. On the 3rd of September 1939, the ship was a day and a half out of New York when a coded message was received in the wheelhouse. Commodore Robert Irving was in command by then, and he was ordered to put his vessel on full war alert. All 2,000 portholes and windows were painted shut with blackout paint loaded in Southampton. There had been 1,275 gas masks for the crew also loaded on board. So that day, the Cunard liner Bosnia and another ship, Athena, had been torpedoed. The BBC broadcast had sent it throughout the ship. Travelers in the Queen Mary were hysterical. Traveling in the ship that time was Bob and Dolores Hope. Also, J.P. Morgan was a passenger on that voyage. The ship was overloaded, 2,300 passengers. People were sleeping in public rooms and corridors. Bob Hope actually put on an impromptu act in the lounge trying to calm people down, and he said people were so upset that no one would laugh at his jokes. But the ship would eventually arrive a day and a half later, successfully in New York. She would be hailed there by the Cunard line. In March of 1940, the ship would be called up to do trooping service. By this time, the newly finished Queen Elizabeth had arrived, but it was the Mary that started trooping first. The early voyages would take her from Boston down into Australia to carry the Australian army up into the Red Sea to fight against General Rommel in Northern Africa. After that business was taken care of, the Anzacs were returned to Australia, and both queens were put on the North Atlantic. And Churchill went and had a visit with General Marshall and President Roosevelt, and Marshall put to Churchill, "How many should we put on them?" talking about the two queens. And Churchill's reply is rather chilling. He said, "Well, if this were only an exercise, you should only put on them what the boats and the rafts can take off. but because of the gravity of the Battle of Britain and the Battle of the Atlantic, we should put all on them that they can carry, but I leave it to yourselves to judge the risks that you will run. And they decided to put at the maximum amount of troops on the Queen Mary. In the summer months, she would carry 15,000 at a time. This ship still holds the world's record for more human beings ever carried on a single crossing in an ocean vessel in the history of the sea. And in July of 1943, the Queen Mary carried 16,683 souls from New York to Scotland.
Obviously, a lot of drama going on, lots of emotions running very, very high on board this amazing ship that many traveled on in good times. And then traveling on for a very, very different reason out of necessity during a very tense time in our history. On board the ship, what does it look like once it becomes a troop ship and a transport ship? How much of the ship changes to accommodate that style of transport and that many people being on board?
The Queen Mary's entrance into the trooping service, the refits were done gradually. In the early days, the ship would only carry about 5,000 troops. The swimming pools were still in use, and they almost had the ship under optimal conditions. But as the severity of the war increased, the need to carry more and more troops took place. So eventually there were bits and pieces of the ship scattered all around the world, where Sydney, Singapore, where the ship had been dry docked early in the war, things that were removable, like the china and the crystal, and a lot of the furniture that wasn't built in was taken out of the ship. A lot of the artwork was covered up with plywood. Miraculously, and almost strangely, a lot of the woodwork in the ship itself was left exposed. So Commodore James Bissett, being a very resourceful captain and one of the wartime captains of the Queen Mary, he would offer every division commander that brought a division of troops on board, he said, "I give you your troops the miles of teak railings around the outside of the ship to carve up as they like, but please do not destroy the precious woods in the ship, because when the war is complete, the ship will need to go back into service as quickly as possible." But as you can imagine, to carry 15,000 troops, standee bunks were put in every corner. Makeshift showers were along the promenade deck. It really was a fair amount of change in the bunking system. When carrying 15,000 troops, there were not enough bunks for all of them to lay down at once. So they had a bunking system which was nicknamed hot bunking. A GI would get that bunk for 6 hours. He'd have to give it up and give it to someone else and find a place in an alleyway or on deck to stay until it was his turn. The first class restaurant was used to mess some 2,500 troops at a time. There were two meals a day. Eggs were boiled using 55-gallon drums, 1,000 at a time, with steam jetted up from the boiler rooms. Officers had it a little better. The first class lounge was retained as an officer's club. The officers also ate at tables in the cabin class dining room and were served from and were able to order from Cunard menus. So there were some changes in the accommodations of the ship. The swimming pool was floored over, and after that would house anywhere from 150 to 200 GIs. The observation bar was also filled with standee bunks. There's one photograph we have in our archive of a GI sitting on the side of his bunk with his hobnail boots on the top of the balustrade in there. So these were not pleasure cruises for these GIs, because many of them had never seen the sea, much less a ship the size of the Queen Mary. You can imagine what it must have smelled like inside, because three-quarters of them were seasick. And Commodore Bissett talks about in one of his autobiographies, nicknamed Commodore or titled Commodore, that on one Christmas, I believe it was 1943, that the chef went all out to knock up a turkey dinner for 10,000, but everyone was so seasick that it went largely uneaten and was put over the side. They were, as Churchill put it, the war was a frightful time, but it was a glittering time. To see the two queens performing magnificently, crossing the Atlantic weekly with a division of troops building up for the successful invasion of continental Europe and to recapture France for the Allies. It was a glittering time, and although 810,000 GIs were eventually ferried in the Queen Mary, and of course many of them didn't come home, but those that did certainly were the heroes of the greatest generation. And I think what Churchill said at the end of the war about the Queen Mary and the Queen Elizabeth rings true. And he said the queens had challenged the furies of Hitlerism in the Battle of the Atlantic. And surely the final day of victory in Europe would have been postponed indefinitely without them. And another one of his comments was that he would like to think that the ships had ended the war at least a year earlier than it might have been. So, and had it not been for the atomic bomb, the Queen Mary and the Queen Elizabeth would have been repositioned in the Pacific to carry troops for a Japanese invasion. But as it turned out, with the dropping of the bomb, the queens were returned earlier than thought. The Lizzie was returned in October of 1945, and the Queen Mary a year later. So they met in their first peacetime splendors in July of 1947. And really, that starts the period of what I've always called the glory days. In the 1950s, between 1947 and 57, still before the advent of jet travel, the queens were crossing the North Atlantic, packed to the gunwales with passengers, full loads every time, 2,000 passengers each way. Old Commodore Marr once told me that they thought they had found the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. And of course, you know, in 1958, with the advent of the 707, a year later, the DC-8, and by the mid-1960s, the development of the 747 was on the table. And another captain of the ship that I spent a lot of time with, Captain Jones, who was actually their last captain, said, "Everett, I'd have one of the queens at sea in the 60s. And he said, "They were rattling across the North Atlantic. We were using 1,000 tons of oil a day to keep to the schedule, and we'd have 1,250 crew looking after only a couple of hundred passengers." And that was really the beginning of the end. It was the twilight of an era. By 1967, the Queen Mary was put up for sale, and a year later, the Queen Elizabeth. And the city of Long Beach, California, would purchase the Queen Mary for a song at $3.5 million, and they would sail their ship to Long Beach, carrying 1,000 passengers, too large to pass through the Panama Canal. The ship would have to go all the way around Cape Horn without air conditioning. So the ship, when that last voyage, we call it Las Palmas, or Lisbon, Las Palmas, across the equator to Rio de Janeiro, around Cape Horn, running into a gale off the coast of Chile, calling it Chile, Peru, the Balboa side of the Panama Canal, Acapulco, and arriving in Long Beach on the 9th of December, 1967. And that morning, as the ship arrived, boats of all sorts and sizes started to come out and follow the Queen Mary up the coast from San Diego. And Captain Jones said by the time he was off Newport Beach that he estimated 5,000 boats around the Queen Mary. And he picked his VHF phone up and called the Coast Guard, and he said, you know, he was Welsh, so they had a tremendous sense of humor. He says, "You better keep those boats away from my ship, because if I hit them, I won't be feeling it, but they will." But, of course, the master mariner that Captain Jones was, brought the Queen Mary safely to Long Beach. And as they approached Queen's Gate, which was appropriately named all the way back in the 1920s by the Army Corps of Engineers, he would later say, "I was happy to have a pre-arranged plan where I did not have to turn the Queen Mary into the harbor. I was able to take her past the gate, around Point Firmin and Palos Verdes in one long, great, graceful circle to show the flag." He said, when I did go through the gate around 11 a.m. on the 9th, and I was alongside at 12, at 12:17, I rang up finished with engines on the telegraphs myself, and I allowed the Queen Mary's great heart to cool forever. And that's really, to hear him say it was very sad. But, you know, even he, years later, was very happy that the Queen Mary had found sort of an immortality in California, that out of all the great liners, she would really be the only one left from that golden era of the 1930s, the golden age of ocean travel. And the ship would carry some 2.2 million passengers in peace, the 810,000 GIs during World War II. She steamed 3.8 million nautical miles. But since opening to the public here in California on the 8th of May, 1971, we estimate we have seen 55 million guests come across the gangway. And that takes me to just one more comment that was made. Lady Mabel Fortescue Harrison, a well-known English psychic, she made a prediction the day the Queen Mary was launched. And she said, most of us will be gone when this takes place, but the ship launched today called the Queen Mary will know her greatest fame and popularity when she never sails another mile or carries another fare-paying passenger. And 50 years later and 55 million guests, the ship is thriving. So there's something remarkable about this ship. I think that maybe it even goes back to when the King and Queen launched the ship that same day that Lady Mabel made that prediction. King George V made one of the most poignant speeches of his entire reign. And I can't remember it all, but some of the things that stuck in my heart were when he said, no longer will she be a number on the books, but a ship with a name in the world, alive with beauty, energy, and strength. Today, we have the happy task of sending forth on her way the stateliest ship now in being. And so the king spoke a soul into the ship from the very beginning. And I think that throughout her travels and war and peace and fair weather and foul, that, you know, she has become her own being almost. I mean, to me, she's a living thing.
It's wonderful that such a ship like this has survived history and time, because all of its predecessors, the other grand ships of the era, they've all been scrapped, they've all been destroyed. She really is the last one in a state like she is, that is still afloat and still standing.
She's it. The SS United States is, the United States is still in existence, but it was post-war, and it was, I don't feel that it was the same pedigree of ship that the Queen Mary is. And so truly from that golden era, which really I suppose was probably from 1907, as far as construction is concerned, from 1907 to 1939, this is the last one.
Ghost stories are synonymous with this ship, obviously. Take me back to the first known, or that you know of, ghost story or paranormal experience that was reported on board the Queen Mary.
Now, there are a lot of crew members that are still living. Waiters, stewards, engineers. They're more junior people because time's portal is staying to its course, as we know it must. And some of them say, no, that's absolutely rubbish. Others that I have known before, because I have had a lot of interaction with captains and department heads, because I started in 1980 at the Queen Mary, and so I've made a lot of travels to England and had a lot of interaction with him. Captain Jones would say this, and he left it at that, and I never questioned it. The Captain Jones said the Queen Mary was the closest thing to a living being that he had ever commanded, that she even breathed. And, well, I think that's saying something. And he also would say, you only had to will her to do something, and she would. I know that I started early in 1981, my career in the Queen Mary, and being raised in the American South, in Alabama, in that, you know, real Bible Belt, I was never raised to believe in anything supernatural or paranormal like that. So when a security guard took me to the side and said, you know, this place is haunted, it kind of upset me, because I thought, you know, he was turning the ship into some freak show. That's how I saw it at the time. And I just, you know, I just sort of, you know, yeah, right, and let it go. And I thought no more about it. And several years went by and nothing, I never noticed anything out of the ordinary. But on a certain Sunday, somewhere around 1985, 86, I can't remember the exact dates, I had a couple of VIPs that I had been showing around. And in those days, there was a wooden catwalk that would go through the boiler rooms where the boilers used to be. And it's right on top of the tank tops. It would go all the way from what used to be the forward engine room to the very bow of the ship where the collision bulkhead is, the first watertight bulkhead. It separates the cargo hold from the forepeak. And I was chatting with my guest right in front of this bulkhead, and I was running my mouth as I usually do, and I began to hear breathing coming from behind the bulkhead. And I really didn't know, I thought I was hearing things. And it became a bit louder and a bit louder, and finally it was plainly audible, and I could feel the breath going down the back of my neck. And without mentioning, I stopped in mid-sentence, and I looked at my guest, and they looked at me, and I realized that they were hearing it as well. And you should have seen three adults clamber up 12 decks and sit on a bench under a lifeboat and not be able to speak, because we didn't know what to say. What do you say when you hear something like that? That's a sealed tank on the other side. There was nobody there. I like to point out that is the collision point where the Queen Mary did in World War II collide with the British cruiser HMS Curaçao, and there were 338 men that passed away in that tragic collision. So, and also being in the cargo hold there. Also in World War II, when the Queen Mary was evacuating the Australian troops out of the Red Sea from after the battle at El Alamein, they were also evacuating German and Italian POWs. And the POWs were housed in the cargo hold. And the heat in the Red Sea at that time of year could have easily been between 110 and 120 degrees. The Queen Mary not air-conditioned, the windows shut, porthole shut because of wartime conditions. It had to be 120 degrees in there. And a lot of people were dying from heat exhaustion. They were having burials on the hour to keep disease from breaking out in the ship. So, you know, there's a history there. There really is. That was my first occurrence, and I didn't know what to make of it.
That's understandable, but take me a little deeper into your mind with not knowing what to make of it after you have some time to let it digest, have some time to kind of let it simmer. Where does your mind go on the topic?
I was really afraid. Why I was afraid, I don't know. I think we're always afraid of something that we don't understand or know about. I think that's just a natural human reaction. You know, I've had other experiences since then. Not long after that, I've really come to terms with the ship. I've never had a negative experience. I've heard the breathing on two other occasions, a total of three times. I've had, on several occasions, I've been nudged or felt someone brush against me, once in a crowded dining room during Sunday brunch, again in an elevator while going down, while I was in the elevator by myself. In 2011, my wife and I spent three nights in cabin M001 for the 75th anniversary, and It was a busy weekend for me, so it was easier for us to stay on board because of all the social things going on that I needed to see too. And I woke up on the 31st of May, and my wife said, I'm going to get coffee. I said, put two shots of espresso in mine. And I laid back down, and she might have been gone 5 minutes, and the bed trembled and stopped. And it was enough to wake me up again. And I thought we'd had an earthquake, because even though the Queen Mary is afloat, it can jostle the water in the lagoon that the Queen Mary's floating in enough to that you feel it. And I could see my uniforms hanging in the closet, and nothing in the cabin was moving. And usually, after we have a little tremor, something is swinging back and forth. And I thought it very odd, and I said, oh, well, and I just laid back down. And as soon as my head hit the pillow, I heard a young lady whisper into my left ear, our young lady's voice. And it was so soft and so faint. But she said, I'm so cold. I'm so very cold. And I was wide awake after that. I wasn't afraid, but I was wide awake. I heard her loud. I heard her very clearly. But I told my wife about it when she got back to the cabin, and my wife said, well, we better go home and feed the cats. But I've stayed in the cabin since, and nothing at all happened. And I commonly take guests in there on tours. It's a beautiful cabin. It's one of my favorites to show. There's something about Mary. There really is. Whether you believe in it or not, and a lot of people don't, but a lot of people do. And I can honestly say that it's a great attraction. People are fascinated with the paranormal these days. I don't think that it's anything evil or bad. I'm not even sure myself if ghosts are people that once lived. And, you know, if I go and I'm able to come back, I'll let you guys know, though. But maybe as we go through our lives as human beings, and we try at everything we do so hard, there's so much human will and zeal and love within us. Well, maybe if the body dies and the spirit does go wherever, maybe there's a reflection of all that we were that's left hanging around. Maybe that's what we notice. Maybe there are people here in the ship because they were happy here. I mean, not only did people die in the ship, but babies were born in the ship too. So there was a lot of life lived within the confines of this steel hull. And so surely I think a ship might be more susceptible to... I mean, it's certainly, the ship takes on its own character as she mothers men and women, as she struggles her way across the ocean, and again in fair weather and in foul. There's something very special in a ship, but whatever it is, I notice it more here than any other ship I've known.
Today, there are ghost tours on board the ship. We've received many, many stories on our other podcast, Real Ghost Stories Online, from people who have gone on the tours. I've even received stories from people who have given the tours. And such an active, active location. Can you share any stories, knowledge that you know of occurrences on those tours on board the Queen Mary?
Yes, and as you say, it's a common occurrence. I mean, it doesn't happen to everybody. Some people come and they really want to have an experience, and they don't have it. Some want to have it really bad, and they do have it. But it's common reports of people being brushed, or people feeling someone like they blew on their neck or something like that. And I don't know if I'm going to mess this story up or not, because it was told to me by a tour guide that they had been in Shaft Alley around door 13, and which is where a young engineer died, and I don't call his name out of respect to his family. They asked us not to. But he was crushed in that watertight door on the 10th of December, 1966. Whether accidentally or foolishly or purposely from another crew member, we don't really know. I kind of like to leave the mystery up to the visitor and let them draw their own conclusions. But in this particular tour, this lady's husband felt someone rub their hand across the face. And as they were walking out of the engine room, he turned around and was talking and said, telling his wife, and there was a smudge of grease on his face. And, of course, the engineer that died had been doing some oiling. He was an oiler, or greaser, as they call him. That was his duties in the engine room. Other activities have, other comments. Cabin B340, which we have just refurbished and started to rent again. We stopped renting it maybe 25, 30 years ago because people had complained of lights going on and off, the water starting and stopping, and when the ship was at sea, there was one passenger that reported having the covers pulled off the bed, and she awakened with a tall man and a dark suit or uniform standing at the foot of the bed, and she reached over and pressed the steward call button, and the steward rushed in. He was close by in his pantry, and she said, did you see him? And he said, who, madam? She said, the man that just ran out of here. He said, madam, I was there the whole time. No one left this cabin. And they finally decided not to rent it after a housekeeper had gone in the early 1980s and made the room up. And she had gone out to her cart to get towels for the bathroom, and the beds that she had just made upon her return had all been heaped up and thrown into the floor, and she knew that no one had gone in because her cart was just outside the door. So, we get a lot of comments that people knock on their doors in the middle of the night, and they go to the door, no one's there. Lights that do go on and off. People bring their meters and things, and I don't know the proper names for all this because I don't actually give these sort of tours, but I know they bring EVP. A lot of that is picked up, and the first night that we had rented B340, people staying in there had their meters out, and our general manager, Stephen Sowards, went through there, and he said that the meters were off the scale.
The thing is, there's some very interesting, if that's the correct word to use, deaths that have occurred on board the ship beyond the accident, beyond wartime.
Some of the other deaths in the ship, there was a second officer that accidentally drank dry cleaning fluid. The staff captain had invited him to stop by his cabin when he got off watch and have a drink, and he did. Of course, the staff wasn't there, so he went in and saw a gin bottle that the steward had been using to spot the staff captain's uniforms, and he drank that and later passed away. Another officer tripped down a stairway up forward there and didn't make it. On the return leg, on the eastbound leg of the maiden voyage, a fellow had fallen from the sports deck down to the sun deck and fractured his skull and died. There are a lot of deaths and passengers, maybe about 50-something deaths with passengers over 31 years, but all of those were from, natural causes, heart attacks, thrombosis, such things as that.
Is there any evidence or ideas on who some of the spirits are that still linger on the ship?
Well, other than the engineer, a lot of the paranormalists say that there is a little girl that haunts the first class pool, and that her name is Jackie. And that's something that we don't have any evidence to back up. In all of the voyage reports and ship's logs that we do have, we don't have any record of any little girl drowning in the pool. However, the Queen Mary would carry 22,000 war brides and between February 1946 and September 1946 and their children. So, and we don't have records from that at all. So it could have easily happened, and we just don't know it. There's supposed to be a lady in white that has been spotted hanging over the piano in the Queen's Salon, which was the main lounge. That room has a lot of spirit to it. Talking about the Queen's Salon, that was the music room. I mean, it was the party room, and in the daytime it would be used for perhaps a string concert or high tea at 11, afternoon tea at 4. But in the evening, the horse racing games would happen and the carpets would be rolled back for cabaret and dancing. And so you just know that the lights of the world have been in that room enjoying themselves. You can feel it when you walk in. You could almost imagine Fred Astaire dancing along, or Clark Gable with Marilyn Maxwell, or the Queen Mother sitting with her entourage in 1954. It's indescribable. It's inexplicable what you feel. And I think a lot of this, what we feel here in the Queen Mary, is what allures her to people when they do get here. Because when you start telling the stories of the history, and people do change. I mean, the Queen Mary's somehow she is a game changer in people. We see it a lot. We see it a whole lot. Not everybody becomes infatuated with the ship, such as myself or you, but most people that spend any time at all with us here, they leave and they have had some sort of remarkable experience that they're going to carry with them for the rest of their lives. And I often ask people, you know, if I'm showing around, if I do a public tour, which I don't do too many anymore because mostly VIPs and stuff, but do allow the ship a place in your heart and share her with others. And I think that she's that kind of a ship.
Let me ask you this, because I've never been on board the ship, but a question that has always run through my mind. Are there areas of the ship today that were once publicly accessible, part of the open area of the ship where passengers could travel and walk around, that are no longer available for the public to peruse, to wander around now that it is in its state of a hotel?
Yes. You know, the ship was altered a pretty good bit when it became a hotel. A lot of these alterations, I believe, were necessary in order to make the ship a more viable shoreside attraction. And one of the things that was done is that the city moved the workaday restaurants up from our deck, which is low in the hull with only portholes, so if you're sitting down, you have no view, to the starboard promenade deck, such as the Promenade Cafe and the Chelsea. You can go in those two restaurants and sit down and have a beautiful view of the Long Beach skyline, which is really magnificent, early in the morning or sunset and at night. Sir Winston's, our signature five-star dining experience, was built up in the sports deck overlooking the fantail of the ship. These are areas that are immensely popular. And some of the areas like the cabin class dining room and the tourist class dining room, with the low overheads that they afforded, have been turned into infrastructure to support the Grand Salon. And the Grand Salon is a banquet room during the week. It can be a meeting room. We could have anything in there from a wedding reception, a quinceañera, a corporate meeting, anything. Our champagne Sunday brunch is in there. So a portion of the tourist class restaurant is used to house the 1,000 tables and chairs that have to be set up in the room. And that room sometimes has to be configured multiple times in a day. If there's a meeting in there in the morning, and a luncheon, and then a party at night, well, that's three times it's going to have to be broken down and reset. The cabin class dining room is divided into the shipping and receiving and the food storage and the coal storage that support all of the restaurants. It's handy to the frame 70 elevator, which is an in-house, back-of-house, or heart-of-house elevator that we use to get everything around the ship. It is a challenge. It is a very big challenge to operate the ship as a shoreside venue. I can assure you that being designed to have all of this that takes place here in mid-Atlantic, it was better organized for that because that is what it was built for. So what we have to do and how we have to do it, It's amazing. It's amazing. We see anywhere from 1.5 million to 1.8 million people every year. Most of them will sleep here and have to be fed here. And that's by far more passengers than that were carried in the ship every year.
One of the neat things I think that you have on the ship every single year is your haunted house, where, of course, you do the paranormal tours year round. But this is more so your somewhat traditional haunted house, where people in costumes and actors and actresses get on board, and it's a fun type haunted house, not necessarily a real haunted house, although on board a haunted ship. Have there ever been any occurrences, have you ever heard any stories of real haunting activity occurring during the fictitious haunted house?
Well, you know, I don't doubt that there is, but I've never heard of any. I know that our event, Dark Harbor, is an enormously popular event. And over the past 10 years, we have really developed that into more and more of an experience. And it's what it does is it brought 140,000+ people to the Queen Mary over 18 nights. And that is an enormous asset to the ship, because October is a notoriously flat month for people in the hospitality business, because everyone is going back to school and people aren't traveling as much. And, you know, when it gets down to operating the Queen Mary, well, you have to consider, well, this ship is getting older and older, so it costs more and more to keep the ship open. And so you have to have more and more to attract the people all times a year. And so, you know, we also do a big holiday event that we've done for the past 4 or 5 years, I believe, called Chill, which started out with an ice kingdom, and then we did some other different things. This last year we had all sorts of ice skating rinks, and it was just a winter wonderland. But the social calendar of the ship, special events, now allow the ship to live on today. I don't think if we had the amount of events that we have, if we would be able to keep the ship alive on just, you know, what is earned. But the special events bring enough people to the property overall to keep things going. And, of course, the ship now is the lease to the city. The ship is owned by a company named Urban Commons, and their dream is to develop the 45 or so acres around the Queen Mary into first-class entertainment, hotel, complex. You can go online, you can Google and see their plans for the property. And the idea is that the property would support the upkeep of the ship for many, many years to come. And of course, you know, we have high hopes for their success, and because the Queen Mary is such an important piece of history that we never want her to be lost. But you know, as we move into the 21st century even further, we will need to think creatively and how to be able to keep that, to keep her going and to keep her viable.
To find out more on the history of the Queen Mary, what it is doing today, how to stay on the Queen Mary, its ghost tours, and more, you can visit its website, queenmary.com. Special thanks to Commodore Everett Horde for joining us and having this conversation today on The Grave Talks. Well, if you like our program, please do subscribe on whatever platform it is you listen to us, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, you name it. Press subscribe, leave us a positive review. That helps us grow in the rankings and allows other folks to find us and know that we exist. Give a moment, please do that. We thank you greatly for your time. Until the next episode, for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.